you know, it's good for the founder to understand the VC. The more the founder understands the VC, the more successful they will be at partnering with the VC,
yeah,
like a long-term marriage, not least of which securing the funding. So,
yeah,
you know, if you want to meet your wife in Rome, Italy, it would help if you speak Italian. It would help if you can be fluent in Italian.
So, hey, Andrew, how are you? I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yep, it's my pleasure. And I think let's just get into it. So who is Andrew Roman? Just an introduction of his small intro.
Sure. So I started off as an entrepreneur. I had little companies and businesses in high school and in college. And then I got into the technology world of enterprise software. And it didn't take me long to start a company that raised a lot of venture capital funding. And once once a VC tells you your founder stock is worth $25 million, after a year or two, you're thinking, well, I'm not going to get a job at Microsoft or Goldman Sachs now. And it becomes a little bit addictive. And so I had a string of startups. And then eventually I made the decision to switch over to the investing side. And so I started a venture capital firm, and we're currently investing out of our fourth fund four.
Yeah.
And we're closing our first international fund right now as well. So we're just on a path to, you know, find the best startups in the world that meet our criteria and support them not only with cash, but with as much support as possible.
Yeah, that's a good introduction. I think I'll go back to the point where you mentioned about you building companies. Why do people really get into investing in general? Why did you get into investing?
Yeah, and I've thought about this a bit, and not only for me, but for others. And I've even tried to guide people away from either leaving a large corporation and going to a VC, or leaving a large corporation going to a startup, or going from a startup and going to a VC. For me, I think that I wanted to do more startups in my finite lifetime. And, you know, I'm not a vampire, so I will not live forever. And how many startups can you do? And can you be effective doing more than one at the same time? And so part of it was that I think there might be a subconscious thing of, what if my next startup is not as good as my last one? So it's kind of like you're a one-hit wonder band and you're afraid of releasing the second album. And all your fans say, oh, we like the old band better than the new one, you know? But I don't know. I mean, there's so much venture capital funding out there. I think it's a far lower risk path right now to start a startup if you've been through it and you know a lot of people. That's a far lower risk proposition than trying to raise a new fund. I think if you know what you're doing, if you've raised the fund, deploying it is a lot of work, and that's rather low risk. But I think for some people, going from founder to VC, especially if your last hit was like a multi-billion-dollar hit, you're like Mark Andreessen is thinking, will I have another Netscape? And I forget, what was the one he did that was like the trying to be a social network for every little industry vertical? But, you know, after like a big failure, I think he was ready to go for venture capital and be diversified.
Yeah. You talked about raising a fund and deploying the fund a little bit there. I think we'll get back to this later in the conversation too. But is it harder to raise a fund or deploy the fund?
Well, it depends who you are. Some people, it's effortless to raise the fund because the fund has been in existence since the 1970s or the 80s or even mid-90s, and all the same investors just re-up. And there may be very little activity other than putting together, you know, fund administrator information for a banker, you know, which we would typically call a placement agent to raise. So for some people, raising the fund is effortless. For an emerging manager is what you call either a new venture capital fund where a new venture capitalist, or even I've been doing this for over 10 years and people still categorize me as an emerging manager because, you know, we didn't start in the 1970s or the 1980s. And I think that, you know, going from raising a fund one, you think raising fund two will be much easier. And then a lot of the people, I mean, I think one of the questions you wanted to talk about was who are the right invest, you know, who invests in the VC fund? And that's different depending on who you are. And so maybe should we address that topic now? Just because it...
No, we can do it later.
Well, for me personally, I far prefer sourcing the startups to invest in, doing the due diligence, negotiating and advising them. There's usually, we're always advising them before we invest. Part of our advice is how much money should the company raise and what should the operating budget be? How many months of runway before they could hit zero cash or possibly break into profitability? All that stuff I far more enjoy. And then after I invest, doing everything we can to leverage our network to support that startup, that's a lot more fun to me than getting on, you know, 18-hour plane rides and being stuck in airport lounges and jet lagged and, you know, being away from my portfolio companies and my actual family, you know, to raise venture capital funding and answering questions that they may not understand. And then educating, there's a lot of kind of academy side of this, in educating your LP base and doing all the reporting, you know. But I think that they're really directly tied together. Right now, we're trying to finish off our fall limited partner report, where we report all the information on all the startups, and it forces us to pull information out of the startups so we can show that to the investors, and that kind of brings a discipline of best practices of how to be a VC. And it's better for the startup to be answering questions of how much cash do I have in the bank? What are revenues this year compared to the last year? And how many months of runway do I have? And what's going well? What's not going well? Explain the team changes. So the fundraising kind of does tie to the fund portfolio management, which definitely results in the CEOs being much more professional and on top of things than saying, oops, I ran out of money and send me more money or the company will go into bankruptcy.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think it depends from person to person, but people have different preferences of what they like to do. I think I'll drift here a little bit. We'll take a step back. And the reason why I actually did this episode was Yuri Zorn. I was like, this is incredible. I've been into VCs and startups since I was 11, and I had to read, like, I don't know, 600 page books in order to learn about things. I just wanted to simplify that for people who might just want to start out, and I think there's a good way to do it. What is venture capital?
So venture capital, you know, today, modern venture capital is that typically a fund manager, someone like me, goes out and raises limited partner capital. So they raise cash from other people. We typically invest in the fund ourselves, and the limited partners require this to see a GP commitment. So we end up with a pool of cash, and some of that cash goes to pay the expenses of running the fund. So office space, salaries, legal, travel, accounting, all kinds of expenses. And then typically, the remainder of that money is the dry powder that we invest in startups. And every fund has its own unique strategy. But for us, we tend to invest about 30% of that money distributed across 25 different startups. And then 75% of the money, we concentrate in follow-on investing into our top-performing startups from the same fund, or even from previous vintage funds that we already raised the money, invested it all. And then one of the startups is like the next Uber or Twitter, and we want to put more money into that. So we do that from the latest fund. And we have very specific policies of when we can invest across a fund. But what you end up having is that you can think of it in a spreadsheet. You'll have, this is the name of the first company we invested in from this fund. This is the amount of dollars, and this is the date. And this is the number of shares we own, and this is the share price. So if you invest $1 million, it'll be this number of shares times that share price equals $1 million that you wired to them buying shares in the company. And then it'll get all the way down to, it'll be like 25 investments. And then there'll be like another 10 or 15 of doing the follow-on investments. And if you get the sum, the sigma of all of that, that'll show how much dry powder after the management fee you invested. Over time, over years and years and years, you'll see some of these companies will run out of money and be forced to sell the business to someone else. And maybe in, we 2X our money. Maybe we just get our money back 1X. Maybe we get zero money back. Those are the bad ones. And so some of these start being marked like, here's $1 million on the left column, and all the way over in the same row, we have zero. And then another one's, here's $1 million. And it raised a larger amount of money at a higher valuation, and our $1 million has a fair market value of $11 million. But that's just what it's worth on the number of shares times the new share price. Sometimes we have something called the power law, that it's almost like you're drilling for oil in different places around the world. And sometimes you spend a lot of money to drill and there's nothing. Sometimes you spend a lot of money and you just get your money back and keep paying the guys on the oil rig. And then sometimes you're like, wow, the Saudi mother load, we've really struck oil here. And so there's a little bit of that, that it's not about being lucky. It's about being diversified enough to neutralize each singular investment risk that over time in years, and now that we're going into fund five, we have a very calm, zen, relaxed approach, knowing that it is nearly impossible to lose money. And the bigger question is, will the fund pay off net of management fees, including the management fees, like 4X, 5X, 6X, 7X, even 10X or better? Anything is possible. You could be diversified and they could all be bad, but especially if they, if most of them have over $1 million of revenue at our entry point when we first invest, these companies are on a path to grow and grow and grow.
Yeah. Awesome. That's an incredible introduction of what VC is. So I think a lot of places you mentioned the word fund. What is a VC fund and what is a VC firm? How are these terms different?
Okay. So you can think of a VC firm as sort of a brand. Like a brand like McDonald's versus Burger King, or Goldman Sachs versus JP Morgan. And they might raise a fund to only invest in, I don't know, food technology companies in India. That would be rather specific. Someone else might make a fund to do only kind of artificial intelligence, automation software companies in Southeast Asia, including Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, or Vietnam or something. So you have different funds to do different things. It's like Sequoia has funds in mainland China, where the Communist Chinese Party is a major LP and has funds. And then you have separate funds in Menlo Park, where it's just investing in US companies or globally. So we as a fund, we're a firm where it's the same people that are doing the investing work and all the diligence and the sourcing and the reporting. And we have partners that help us do the fund administration and accounting and tax returns for our investors and for us and the fund. And then we have specific funds. So a fund will raise a finite amount of money. It'll invest that money completely. And eventually we divest from each startup we invested in, from either the company going public and doing an initial public offering, an IPO on the stock exchange. And then we have to survive a certain number of weeks or months of a lockup before we can sell on the open market, divesting, getting our money back. And sometimes we divest and give cash to our investors, our limited partners, which is the capital we're investing. Sometimes we say, look, we think that if you sold your Apple computer stock right after the lockup, you would have missed 99% of the value of what became the world's biggest, most valuable multi-trillion-dollar company. So sometimes we distribute the stock to the LP if they want to hold on the stock because they think the IPO is just the beginning. The other way we exit and return the money, which is the most common positive outcome, is M&A, mergers and acquisitions, that we fund a private company, it gets bigger, someone buys the company. And then if IBM buys it, it could become a multi-billion dollar reoccurring revenue stream, even though they only bought the company for $500 million and we invested at a $10 million valuation or blended over a few rounds to maybe a $20 million valuation. So at an average entry point of $20 million, we sell for $500 million and that's paying back a lot of the fund with cash. The third way people can get their money out of a privately held deal is you invest in a company at one valuation, now they're raising funding at a much, much higher valuation, like in the billions. And we say, we've been in this deal for 7 years. I think if we sell just 25% of what the fund owns, like if we have 100 shares, let's sell 25 shares and that'll return half of the fund and we'll leave the other 75%, 75 shares to ride that winner into the sunset and sell at an even higher valuation. Now, who knows? There could be a volcano and a tsunami and a war and a famine and a plague. And maybe we were lucky we got anything out of it and it blows up in a war or something. So I would say diversification is the biggest pillar of reason that a venture capital fund should stick to. A VC fund should not raise money to make one investment only. And of course, there's the founder side. Yeah. So I'm kind of giving you very much what the world looks like through my glasses of the fund manager running the firm and running each fund and what the limited partner gets that they invest in the fund and they get their money back with a multiple. With the startups, they're getting cash to grow their business, to build products that they couldn't get to profitably with reasonable growth. You know, some of these things like semiconductors or drug discovery biotech, we don't do that. But it's a hyperbole example that without funding, this is never going to happen. And that is true to some extent for almost everything a VC will invest in. So the startups partner with VCs to raise the cash that they need to build their products and services and high growth, high velocity businesses. But they should be also looking at what is the brand of the firm, not just the fund. What reputation does that firm have? And do they have a reputation for being founder friendly and good to work with? Do they have a reputation of getting very angry and screaming and being, you know, out of control? Do they have a reputation for every time they invest, your next investment will be much easier? It's kind of like if Goldman Sachs is leading your IPO as the lead underwriter, that's a good signal to the market that this is a good issuance. If it's a little boiler room Long Island investment bank, you know, with some guys that look like they just got out of prison in the mafia, that's not as good a signal. Yeah. You know, if you remember the movie Boiler Room with Ben Affleck and, you know, Jonah Hill. So there's you are raising from a brand when you raise venture capital funding, and there should be a reason why that brand is good or bad.
Yeah, awesome. So a couple of things. You mentioned the three ways in which a VC fund gets its money back. Either an acquisition, an IPO, or selling its shares when the company is another round. What is the most...
We call that secondaries. That secondaries because normally if a fund is an investor is putting money to buy shares in a company, like you're buying Tesla stock, Elon Musk gets the money and he can spend it as a primary investment into the company to build the business with more cash. When one investor or even founder is selling shares to a secondary buyer on the secondary market, that money goes into the pocket of the individual or the seller, and it doesn't go to the company, to Elon, to build the business further. So it's IPO, M&A, secondaries.
Yeah. And as a fun, which one of them is the most desired by you guys?
Well, I suppose you could say the most desired is to IPO, and that typically would have the largest enterprise value exit. So the optimal game here is to buy low and sell high.
Yeah.
And if you get to an IPO on a big boy exchange, like the NASDAQ, the New York Stock Exchange, the LSE, you expect you did really well. The flip side of that is it often takes many years to get to an IPO. And so that puts pressure on your internal rate of return, the IRR. And
yeah.
So sometimes I would say the kind of dream that people are looking for is like people think of MySpace as a failure compared to Facebook. Let me tell you, I wish that we invested in 25 MySpaces with every fund within 24 months. And between the time that they launch the website, Rupert Murdoch bought it for $550 million. And you invested in that thing at like $10 million. And so you get all your money back in like a year, or yeah. Instagram or WhatsApp. These were crazy M&A outcomes that happened very quickly rather than the patience. Like, you know, people make fun of how young Obama looked when he became the president of the United States and how old he looked after a couple of years. You know, it's nice to get that payout while we're still young and handsome here and not wait so many years. So I think it's good to have some IPOs in every fund. And it's yeah. nice to have already paid back all your investors, all of their money, plus a good return. And then when the IPO comes, you're like, oh boy, come to my house. We're going to have a celebration with the CEO on the success of this IPO that took us 7 or 8 years to get to.
Yeah. For sure, that's an incredible. What is your actually the 7BC? What is your totally assets in the market?
Well, right now with our new fund, AUM is north of $325 million.
Yeah, and what is the fund size for the latest fund?
So the latest fund, which is this international fund, is $200 million.
Yeah. Awesome. So you guys are raising these funds. You are on your fifth fund. How does a fund really come into existence? You build the brand, you build the firm. But how do you get these millions of dollars from LPs? And what does that whole process look like?
Well, so it's a different story for different types of funds. So in our first funds, we basically went to individual people that we knew from my previous business. So I was running a venture capital equity exchange fund called the Founders Club, where secondaries were very taboo. And so founders would go for years being worth a lot of money on paper, but having a small salary. And it's not easy to live in San Francisco, New York, or London with such a low salary. All your friends are rich from MBA business school and you're poor. So we enabled the founders to put some of their founder stock into a limited partnership in exchange for ownership, limited partnership unit. So basically imagine 25 startups, they all put 10% of their stock into a pool. And now that pool is sort of communist. Whenever there's an exit, everybody gets paid. And then when secondaries came out and became more normal, when the startups were staying private for so long, people had to get liquid before the M&A, before the IPO. I was really at the beginning and the head of that, and I helped broker and help people sell their shares on the secondary market. And then I found the secondary market was getting too crowded and nobody cared about our network. And I thought our network, our value add, is worth more than our cash US dollar commodity check. And so we raised a fund from CEOs and founders of venture-backed companies, as well as actually VCs investing out of their own personal savings and sometimes out of their GP management companies. And then quite a few kind of Silicon Valley and some New York investment bankers where their primary job is doing the M&A sell side and sometimes buy side M&A. So we ended up with 100% ecosystem people, which as a network was very different than other funds because these guys were starting companies. They know the other founders. They're sourcing new deals for us to invest in. There's usually a subject matter expert in the network for almost anything. And then after we invest, we have these barbecues and networking events and dinners where everybody meets everybody. And these guys are adding value to the startup after we invested, helping the ones that are dying and increasing the outcome for the ones that are doing well. A lot of other VC funds, and we're now making this transition from high net worth individuals and family offices. So you might be a really rich person, but then you get to the point that you're so rich that you're hiring people to work for you to help you invest the money properly, to do actual, like it's their full-time job, investing and managing and making sure you don't lose all this money that you've made somehow. And so these are family offices, single family offices. Yeah. We've had single family offices in most of our funds, or from fund 2, 3, 4 and fund 5. A lot of other VCs, the ones that are, I think of them as dynasties that have been around since the 1970s and 80s, they raise their money from endowments, pension funds, insurance companies, sovereign wealth funds, multifamily offices, very large pools of capital. So if you take the Caisse de dépôt of Quebec, they have over $400 million as a pool of money that if I show them my fund is $200 million, they say our minimum check is $50 million and we don't want to be more than 10% of your LP investor base. So that would mean the minimum fund size needs to be $500 million. And, you know, in some ways, that's not even a venture capital fund anymore. You know, they need to be writing big checks. Yeah, I mean, it's just different. So, which presents opportunities for us to introduce our startup portfolio companies to those guys that we know that are getting funding from the Caisse de dépôt that have a $1 billion plus fund, and they're really looking to 2x that fund. Imagine if you and I had a $1 billion fund every 2 years, and all we do is 2x the fund. So after many years, we pay back the $1 billion, and we have $1 billion in profit. That means that you and I would have 20% of the profit, which is the carried interest or carry, and that's $200 million, and we have a new fund every 2 years. So they're not trying to do real alchemy on that late stage growth. They're just trying to like 2X, maybe they could 4X the fund when they get really lucky, or maybe it's just a 1.2X and they survive to raise the next fund. So whereas for us, so that means that you've got these kind of very large pools of capital. If you're the pension fund of the New York City Police Department, you know that these guys that are out there on the street today will retire 10 years from now, and we have to pay them their pension, their kind of salary, in 12, 15 years from now. So if they invest into venture capital and it's illiquid, no secondaries, just waiting for IPOs, and the $50, $100 million check comes back as $100, $200 million, that works. That's very suitable for them. With us, our investor base has been much more individual people who are thinking, my twin girls are going to go to Harvard. I need money to pay for the tuition. It's like a regular family. And so our investors are not as patient to wait for the IPO and the M&A. And that's why secondaries has become part of our strategy to return the fund faster. And then being a small and more nimble fund, we're able to make 6X, 7X, 12X cash on cash return, which is much bigger than the 2X or 3X return. But the fund is smaller as well.
Yeah. And I think it's the same thing with funds of funds. That's how they really work too, or is it different for them too?
So a fund of fund, an FOF, is a fund that is designed to invest into other funds. And so within the venture capital world, you could, for example, raise, you know, $500 million and then start investing that money into a VC fund like mine. And what happens is you start stacking fees on fees. So I'm getting a 2% annual management fee on the money every year over 10 years. And I'm taking a 20% performance fee, which is the carried interest or carry. And then the fund of funds, it used to be 2%, you know, 40 years ago, then it fell to 1%. And there's a lot of pressure to go to like 0.8%. And sometimes it's like Silicon Valley Bank that's really got another way that they're making money and they're charging just like cost. And then they're saying after their LP gets all their money back, they're taking something like a 10% performance fee carry. And you start to see a layer of that. There's some good fund to fund plus cherry pick direct investing strategies where someone raises a fund of funds and they say, we're going to invest half of it into VCs and the other half of it, we're going to co-invest into the portfolios of all these managers that we're backing. So you could be sitting in India and have the inside track on what's happening in Palo Alto, San Francisco, Austin, New York, and get into those deals, possibly without even traveling. But that's where you have not just the fund, you've got the firm. And do these founders see you as a value-added investor that they want to have a press release announcing who led their Series B or C or D or F, you know, growth funding rounds?
So I think I have two things which would come to a person's mind too. Why is the management fees 2%? And I think it does change over time, but what is it dependent upon that makes the change?
Yeah, I think that this model goes back to ancient shipping in the Mediterranean that, you know, some people think it was in Pisa, Italy, like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, that said, okay, we're going to pay for the construction of this big ship and we're going to pay for all the men to be on that boat and take that boat all the way to India, load it up with spices. And if you can survive without sinking to the bottom of the ocean, that if you can come back filled with this arbitrage of treasure, you get to keep 20% of what you carried. So it's literally like what you carried in your arms and on the boat, you get to keep that. And then it became called carry. And so 20% was sort of a standard thing. You know, Christopher Columbus was like a venture capital investment deal, you know, that he raised funding in Spain, not his native Genoa, Italy, to be funded, you know, to find another route to the to India, right? So I think it kind of comes from that. I personally think I would like to break free of the shackles of the 2-in-20 model and raise a larger fund where we just go public. And so we become an evergreen fund. And then in year 3, where it's almost a certainty that we would be up on the J curve, that you invest in 50 companies, 40 of them raise a larger amount of funding at a higher valuation. So the number of shares times the share price is up. There might be a few that are down, but net-net, we're up. By year 3, we should be able to go public. And anyone that invests in our fund, we say, look, by going public, there's a good chance that you're up in value and you can sell and be liquid and not be as patient as the pension fund of the New York City Police Department. And you can get your money back while you're young and handsome. And then when we exit from an M&A or an IPO at the portfolio layer, that money comes back onto the balance sheet to be recycled and reinvested. So we just become an evergreen snowball fund. And we could charge a management fee on the NAV, maybe 2% of the NAV to attract and retain a high quality team and best of breed technology and accounting and everything. But the 2-in-20 model has been around for a long time. I think the Draper family tell me they were the first 2 and 20 model west of the Mississippi. But you kind of had these Rockefeller, kind of robber baron, super rich families that came out of, you know, the steel industry and New York City and Boston, that like the Bessemer family that were investing in the U.S. railroads, you know, with cowboys and Indians kind of times. So you could argue that those were some of the early venture capital firms that became brands. And now they're investing with other people's money today. So Bessemer still exists. So does Venrock, which is the Rockefeller family.
Yeah, for sure. I think, this is incredible. Now I have to say, like, looking at from a layman's perspective, a lot of people will learn a lot from it. But I think we're talking about LPs and raising the fund. One thing which just came to my mind that I was reading about a couple of days ago, Masayoshi Son raised $100 billion for the Vision Fund, so for SoftBank. What do you think separates that kind of fund from a normal regular VC fund, apart from the fund size, of course?
Well, I think that if you say how many people work at SoftBank in the firm, and what is their portfolio construction? So ultimately, a VC firm should have a spreadsheet for each fund where they plan out how many companies are we going to invest in at which stage. Now, you've got, you know, Sam Altman's OpenAI has brought in like the original designers of Apple and the iPhone and all that to come up with like the Eye of Sky. And so it's a $1 billion seed investment round. Now, it's unlikely for it to be a total failure, but normally when you invest in seed, you want to diversify into a lot of companies. If you're investing in like EBITDA positive, like a PE firm, you could have a more concentrated portfolio of maybe even like 5 or 7 portfolio companies. When you look at Ron Conway doing pre-seed, pre-product, pre-revenue companies at scale, he was doing like 250 companies per fund. And I have friends in San Francisco that I've helped raise LP money for, so I know a lot about their funds, where they have like 600 companies in one fund. When I generally hear about a $100 billion fund itself, I think this is not venture capital, and that most startups today have a certain amount of capital requirements that they need to last a certain period of time and kind of prove the Bunsen burner science experiment. Like if you were trying to make a drug to cure Corona, COVID-19 or Ebola or AIDS or something, and you're going to test it on animals first, and then only if you get good efficacy, does that open the gate to raise more money to test on some initial set of humans, prisoners. And then if you get good efficacy on the prisoners, does that open the gate for more funding? So it's sort of, you know, I kind of grew up in a world of milestone-based funding that you don't give them all the money now to pay for the battle of FDA, Food and Drug Administration approval, so you can sell it in the United States. If you didn't know, if it doesn't make, you know, your body parts fall off from just taking it. So you kind of got to go through some milestones before you get all the money. If you put all the money into that company at day one and you get bad efficacy, well, what are you going to do? Just pivot with the management team that you funded or ask them politely to return the money? So I don't really think of that so much as venture capital. And yet you see these deals that could happen nowhere else, like a $1 billion seed deal. We've got, you know, OpenAI, Microsoft. I generally think that if you gave me $100 billion, I would use a fund of funds cherry pick strategy, and I would have small teams in every city and doing some pre-revenue deals with a little bit of the fund. I would be doing kind of late stage seed where I see the optimal risk reward inflection point. And then we put more money into the Series A rounds. And if we were evergreen, we could be multi-stage and fund them with $50, $75, $100 million checks. But before I would put $1 billion into one company, I would rather create an entire ecosystem in somewhere different, like South America, Latin America, Southeast Asia, Africa, something like that. And I think that, you know, I've just gotten used to the fact that we should perform better than other asset classes. If you have to wait years and years and years, you should be delivering far more than the stock market. God help you, fixed income of treasury bills going up with central bank rates going up. VCs just have to deliver more.
Yeah.
So I think $100 billion fund is under massive fund physics to be able to deliver like a 7x, 10x net of all the losses and management fees.
Yeah. So what really happens? I'll dive a little bit deeper into management fees and carry. What happens with the management fees that you guys get from like the fund?
So, you know, take, for example, a $100 million fund. Let's take a real example.
Yeah.
$100 million fund is not that big a fund compared to a lot of the VCs that are out there, not least of which SoftBank, if you are willing to call that venture capital. And 2% of $100 million is $2 million a year. And let's say that, you know, you've got two co-founders that are the two GPs, or maybe even five. So that $2 million is starting to get split up quite a bit. And if you think about it on a quarterly basis and a monthly basis, and then you think we need to hire, you know, some venture analysts, we need to hire some associates, we want them to live in San Francisco, New York City. These are expensive places to live in. If you're not paying your associate above a certain amount of money, you'll find that after 2 years, a bigger fund is hiring them away and benefiting from all their network and skills that they've learned. So the $2 million is almost gone immediately. There's also, you know, little administrative expenses that are, you know, could end up being not so little. We've got a number of funds. There's fund formation expenses. We have SPVs where we raise money just to invest in the follow-on rounds after our fund has stopped investing. We end up with a lot of SPVs. So our accounting bill becomes pretty big. The administration, we have a fund administrator that deals with sending all the tax documents, financial statements, and K-1s so our LPs can do their taxes on time. That the management fee is typically not seen to be the source of capital. I suppose if you had $2 billion annual management fee at SoftBank, you could hire a lot of people with $1 billion. And then $1 billion could really be compensation for, you know, a concentrated set of general partners that are taking most of the cake, you know, on what's left there. But normally, I think most VCs are, you know, have to put money into the fund themselves as limited partners. So we need to invest our savings on each fund. And as the funds get bigger, that means more money goes into it. So there's a little bit of like, get paid in heaven here of you keep getting more and more and more pulled into your own fund. And it's the carried interest that is truly the compensation that a VC should be shooting for. And because it can take a long time, it's good for if you're going into the venture capital career path that you're not thinking, I'm going to get rich quickly. This is a patient person's game. I would stress.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. I mean, I think I recently heard somewhere, I don't recollect where, but it's kind of carry interest and management fees have kind of become very standard way of making money as a VC firm. So a lot of VC firms are investing a lot into media and all those things to increase their source of income. So do you think is that what new age funds should really do?
I don't think so. I think that, we do a lot of inclusive events and then we do exclusive events. So our exclusive events exclude most of the people and it's only for our kind of VIP, our VIP. So all of our limited partners and all of our portfolio companies and our team come together. And so it's kind of like the old dinner of the Founders Club. Everyone introduce yourself. We all own part of each other, so help each other. So we're kind of aligned. Those events cost us money and they're free for everyone to attend. And we're using management fee from their investments. And the portfolio companies are happy to finally get not just cash for runway, but help in a network to help them be successful. We sometimes do inclusive events. Like we have an event coming up in San Francisco on November 14th, which is a Tuesday evening, where we have a VC panel of five or six VCs that are friends of mine. And we'll have two or three of our portfolio companies from Silicon Valley present. And there's a lot of food, drinks, networking. So it's really high quality networking of our network, but it includes everybody. And like anyone can register for it. I mean, we sometimes have a sponsor. We charge money to people that we don't know to attend it. And there's a little bit of income, but I certainly do not think of that as an additional revenue stream to amplify our management fee and carried interest. The purpose that we do those things is purely just for networking and supporting the portfolio and keep animating the network. If you have a big network and you never animate it, then it's worthless. If you're out of sight and out of mind, this is the opposite. This is like get together, get excited, see a company that we're in, see if you want to invest in that with me, see if you can open the door and help it. Maybe you get excited and invest in our next fund, and it wasn't an overnight decision. You've been coming to our events for 10, 20 years, and now you're ready to, you sold your business, now you're ready to come in, you know us. That's how I think of that. On media, like I remember the first time I set up my podcast, I switched monetization off. I don't want any advertisements. I didn't want any advertisements coming in there because I was afraid that people would abandon and not want to listen to the ads. And I would almost pay money to not have the ads, like paying for Spotify, YouTube with no ads kind of thing. You know, and media companies as a portfolio company to invest in are typically not going to make the sort of venture returns the way more of a product service, disruptive business model, you know, generative AI, automating human workflows, leveraging data, the kind of investment thesis that we're into. But I have seen some guys do put on big events and they get lots of sponsors and they rent out a whole stadium or something. And they're actually getting into the event business. And that may help them fight the tough fight when it might've been difficult going from fund three to fund four if they didn't have sovereign wealth funds and endowments and pension funds just re-upping in every fund without waiting for them to deliver the returns.
What are some technical terms which you think fund managers should be aware of when raising their first fund or just starting out?
Well, I mean, there's all the terminology that have to do with completing an investment into a startup. And one should be 100% fluent in all of that. So things like pre-money valuation, size of the round, post-money valuation, other terms like participating preferred, liquidation preferences, non-participating preferred, things that if you don't pay attention, when the company is sold via M&A, you'll see a waterfall of she got her money before me, I got my money before her. You know, how is the pizza pie going to be split up in the end when it's real exit consideration of cash and stock? So it's important for a fund manager to know all of this stuff. If they don't know that, they probably should not be raising a fund or being put in charge of deploying and managing a fund in a portfolio. On the fund side, the metrics that most LPs pay most attention to are the multiple on invested capital, MOIC.
Yeah.
And so that's like, if I invested $1 million, what's the fair market value of that? There's also, I prefer TVPI, which is total value to paid in, which considers the management fee. Like, why should we ignore if this guy put in $1 million, and 2% times 10 years is going to strip out 200,000. We only invested 800K. I want to see the value of the 800K invested plus the 200K that went to pay all these expenses. So that's TVPI. And TVPI and MOIC are a little bit like on paper returns. Like I jokingly say, Jerry Maguire in the movie says, show me the money. Well, how about wire me the money? So VCs love to show you the money, but not get wire it to you. So actual distributions where you go a step beyond Jerry Maguire and you wire me the money, that's DPI. So it's distributions to pay it in. So what ends up happening is that you have that spreadsheet we talked about at the beginning of this call of how much money did I deploy and how much is that? Let's say $100 million invested in startups. And then you have this TVPI, inclusive of the management fee, that says my $100 million is now worth $400 million. But we think it'll double and eventually return $800 million, which would be an 8x cash-on-cash multiple of the fund. So eventually, your paper returns of TVPI should convert to a final DPI, distributions to paid in. And so how much money did the LP invest and how much money did they get as a multiple of the money invested? And then they should think, how long did I have to wait to get this? And so as a formal way of considering the time value of money, you have an internal rate of return or an IRR. So if you invest in a company and it goes up in valuation, so you invest $1 million and the company is doing so well, they raise $25 million on $100 million pre in a short period of time. Well, your IRR looks great because it went up by a lot in a short period of time. If it stays private after years, that IRR will come down. So And a final metric that I like to speak to and maybe makes the most sense to your audience is, what is the cash on cash multiple? Don't confuse me with your management fees and your carried interest. I gave you X number of dollars. How much did you return back to me? Did I lose money? Very few VCs will ever lose money. And if I made money, what is the cash on cash multiple? Would I have been better putting this into real estate or the stock market, or hedge funds, or fixed income, or your VC fund? And normally the VC fund has a pretty good cash on cash multiple, but it's probably taking, you know, longer than they would have expected. So a good LP is diversified into lots of different publicly traded equities in emerging markets in the US and multi-tenant commercial real estate, multi-tenant, residential real estate, different parts of the world, PE, fixed income, all that stuff. So the key ones for the VC side are MOIC, multiple on invested capital, TVPI, total value to pay it in, DPI, the distributions to pay it in, the real money, cash on cash, and IRR, internal rate of return. These are things that the world will judge you for as a venture capitalist.
Yeah, I think we talked a lot about there. Anything that you think would act as additional information that would be it? Anything?
Yeah, I would say that people think of venture capital as the risky part of their investment portfolio. Like, I speak French and German, and the actual word for translation of venture capital is capital risque, which means risk capital. And in German, it's Risikokapital. And so they're like putting a tattoo on our faces saying, be prepared to lose everything. Like, welcome to Las Vegas, Macau, Monaco, spin the roulette wheel and maybe get rich and drive off like James Bond, or more probably walk out with your wife hitting you in the face saying, you idiot, you're gambling the money like it's a lotto ticket. This is really not true. I think, the real truth is that if you've been in this game your whole life, you get a lot of deal flow. So someone will listen to this podcast and email me their startup, just more deal flow. And so we have a funnel that looks through so much, and we end up pulling the trigger into companies that end up in that spreadsheet over years of time. Some of them go to zero. Some of them, we just get our money back. Some of them return really nice. And some of them return the whole fund. You get the whole fund back from just this one. You get the whole fund back from just this one. And when you net it together, don't get upset when the companies are dying. Just have compassion in your heart to help the individual people that have to go back and fire everyone in their team because they're running out of money, you know? So it's a tough thing. But net net, it's very safe for the investor who invests in the fund and for the VC running the firm. You know, it's a patient person's game, but it's a relatively safe thing. And when you have a window to exit, you know, you probably want to consider it. Maybe don't sell everything, but sell something, because IPO and M&A is taking a long time. There's been a lot of delays for us in really getting the money out without secondaries.
Yeah. The secondaries should be last option or last resort or...
No, not necessarily. Like this is where it's the Jerry Maguire thing. Like, if you know, we invested in certain companies at like an $8 million valuation, and then years later, it raises money at a $2.5 billion valuation. Like that one investment returns the whole fund multiple times. To sell nothing, and I keep sending emails to my LPs saying, look, I realize that your mother has died and you're getting older and your children have gone to college and don't even know how to ski. You know, I mean, it's a bit of making a joke, but like, I think it makes sense to sell 10% or 20%. Now, if you have Tim Draper and he's just investing his own money and his Bitcoin investing alone has just made just, you know, enormous fortunes of money, he might be thinking, I don't need to see this money come out in my lifetime. I'm investing for like my charitable estate, you know? But for me, I dragged a lot of my friends to invest into the fund. And so I like the idea of I can pick five or six of them between year two and year four and get 100% of their money back. Now there's absolutely no risk. Everything else is just TVPI, MOIC, paper returns of what we expect to come. Maybe we double from here, you know? And then they can invest in the next fund. So I would say secondaries are a complex issue that have been culturally evolving. You know, it's like women driving in Saudi Arabia is a relatively new thing, but everyone seems to think it's a good idea. I would support that. A lot of people have mixed feelings of, I don't like anybody selling until the final outcome of the company. But I think that our reality is sometimes a little different. But the biggest power law returns I expect to come from IPOs and a couple of just poster M&A events. The secondary thing helps us return money so people can be in every fund or at least, you know, tell their spouse, we're doing really well with this. And in fact, it's real. They gave us all the money back. Yeah. As opposed to just emails and showing paper returns.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Incredible points. I think the secondary, I've been reading a lot about this and hearing a lot about this. It is kind of, different people have different thoughts on it, but yeah, at the end of the day, depends upon the VC fund.
It depends on the individual too. Like if you see a founder, sometimes a founder is saying, I want to sell $30 million on the secondary market and push back the IPO for another 2 years. And, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing her not taking any secondary and start the IPO process now. That'll take 4 or 6 months. It's going to push us into 2024. We might have a lockup of 6 months after that. I might not be able to get money out for 1 year. And so if she does a secondary and takes out $30 million personally, you know, that might push me back 3-4 years. So sometimes you think
it makes a lot of sense for the founder to get secondary liquidity. Other times you're thinking, on this one, I don't like it. Or the company's not even through the woods. Why is the founder taking chips off the table? We don't even know if this works yet. And I've seen that happen. You know, so secondaries need to be looked at as an individual case every single time. There's no, here's my policy for all secondaries, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
But as the companies used to go public, in the 90s when you had like 200 million of top line revenue and decent growth.
Yeah.
Now you see these companies with multi-billion dollar valuations and not going public anytime soon. So I think it's kind of forced the secondary market to become part of the asset class for emerging managers at a minimum.
Yeah, but going public is really, it's just another tool to raise more money. That's, it's not really, or is it anything?
Well, that depends. Like I used to live in London during a time when the alternative investment market, which was like the baby stock exchange of the London Stock Exchange, was taking off. And AIM became an alternative to venture capital, where you just get a nomad nominated advisor to put their stamp on it. Then they distribute it to their broker networks and they burn up the phones calling, I don't know, rich people in Mumbai to Cape Town and Australia. And then money comes in and it's a funding vehicle. You're listed, but if your market capitalization, the total enterprise value is under 100 million sterling pounds, there was no liquidity. So it was purely a funding event, like you said. When you got above 100 million market cap, there tended to be legitimate trading volume and daily trading. And so there's bid ask price and you could sell. So if you own part of that company and it's got above 100 million, it was not only a fundraising exercise, this was a liquidity event, you know, for investors and founders to begin to sell some of their stock and get out. You know, you look at a lot of companies like Tesla and all these companies got such big valuations without going public, like Palantir and Uber and Lyft. Yeah. You know, when you see Carl Icahn investing $350 million into a venture capital deal, I say this is not venture capital anymore. That's a publicly traded, disruptive, you know, investor letter kind of guy. So the world's changed, and to not... So if the startup went from like early stage to this much revenue to this much revenue, and they would always go public here, and now they cross that line and they stay private. Well, between here and here, maybe there should be some liquidity, not on the stock market, but between two sophisticated investors, and complete a discrete secondary transaction of selling some of your equity. What's interesting about that is that we're able to have insider trading information, which is legal. We have information rights. The CEO has to give us information. They cannot raise money without us exercising our pro rata equity right. So the idea that you can be almost a publicly traded liquid person, but in the private with all the shields and protections and preferred shareholder rights and privileges is like legal insider trading information in a way, that there is liquidity in a privately held company that reaches a certain level. So to avoid secondaries completely would be to not understand the massive changes that have happened in the industry over the last 12 years and almost radically in the last 5 years.
Is there a difference between, is there a reason why specific founders don't want to go public?
Sure. Yeah. When you're publicly traded, you've got to file an S-1 in the United States.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's like a big private placement memorandum, PPM type of document. You go through, it takes up a lot of your time. So if you enjoy running your business and overseeing your engineering, developing the product, sales team, entering new markets, let's go to Southeast Asia, let's go to Europe, let's go to Latin America, let's go to India. They're almost enjoying their job. When you become a publicly traded CEO, you're filing all kinds of reports and it's audited, and actually a whole bunch of Wall Street stock exchange, you know, the street will value your price. Everybody converts to one class of shares, which is good for the founder to remove that waterfall of who gets paid out. Everyone gets pushed into one class of shares. That's generally considered fantastic for the founder, but they have to live with a publicly traded company. If you remember, Facebook didn't want to go public, but there was so much secondary trading that they had more shareholders than was legal. And so to be legally compliant, they had to go public. And then, you know, they were not proving that they were good on mobile yet. And it was really stressful for Zuck to be running that business. It's wonderful to be behind a curtain and nobody really knows what's going on. and they just say, oh, my business is valued at $10 billion. I'm a decacorn. And there's no analysis from the Carl Icahn team saying, actually, I think you're overvalued. You know, so I think it's a bit stressful to run a publicly traded company. And most CEOs would prefer the pleasure of, I don't think they're leaving the office at 4:59 p.m. every day to go to the gym. But when you're a publicly traded CEO, at any minute, you know, reporters chasing you around for information and comments, any little scandal is a blow up. There's things that happen of sex scandals or bad things in privately held companies. And thank God no one is hearing about these things. When you're going public, the public has a spotlight on you and is paying attention. It's a different thing. You know, on the other hand, I think it's exciting for some founders to become like a Steve Jobs and you go public. It's not a quick flip. I'm not buying houses, putting some lipstick on the kitchen and bathroom and selling it at a higher price after I doll it up a little bit and put some new grass in front of it. This is, I'm going to build a long-term sustainable tech titan that will become a multi-trillion dollar company and be like Jeff Bezos, get into everything and become a global world dominating conglomerate and change the world and become the consolidator that buys companies, not the one who just sells quickly, returns VC money. So it's a more permanent path. That's why for me personally, I think this 2-in-20 model, which you ask the Drapers where if they're the ones behind it, you know, but the 2-in-20 model kind of forces us to sell, or we can hold on to shares if it goes public. I kind of like the idea of being a permanent fund that only gets bigger and it eventually goes all over the world. And so if you have a choice of raising money from an Indian investor who's like in New Delhi and you're in New Delhi, or we have a New Delhi office, then those guys were born and raised in New Delhi. They understand the culture and everything. But then they say, we have offices in all over Europe and the United States and Latin America and Southeast Asia and the Middle East. They're like, well, I'll go with these guys because they have network immediately to help me grow my business, you know?
Yeah. For sure.
But also a final short answer though, you know, after the dot-com meltdown in 2001 and the dot-com crash of, you know, all the eToys went to zero kind of thing. It was like a crypto crash. The US government passed legislation through the SEC and supervised by FINRA that the cost of an IPO skyrocketed to like $6 million. Ask Tim Draper about this. He gets like, he's got a rant that he'll tell you about $6 million to IPO, $6 million in annual compliance, so much work and distraction from running and building a business that all you do is deal with the government regulators. It is just God awful. And so we entered a stay private forever era, which ushered in the necessity of enabling early founders and early investors to exchange some of their shares, not in the publicly traded market, but to other buyers.
Awesome. I think this has been incredible. I learned a lot from this one. I had been learning about this for a couple of months now, and around years, one or two years. And I think this one was kind of a good refresher. But yeah, that's it from my side. Anything you'd like to say?
No, just thank you so much and keep doing this. I'll make sure I try not to miss an episode from you. You've got some cool guests coming on with the Drapers.